AT&T Radio wants you to get on our soapbox because your opinion matters. Tell us what you really think at tntradio.live. Upload a video, some audio, or drop us a note on TNT Radio's soapbox. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's news talk, TNT Radio.
This is the Malcolm Roberts Show
on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Good afternoon. My name is Chris Spicer here on the Malcolm Roberts Show, filling in for Malcolm, who was unable to be here today. Look, we've got a great show for you guys. We're talking to, two ladies who I've read their paper previously, and I'm really looking forward to having a chat to them about it. So we've got Connie. Now, Connie.
Yeah. Hi, Chris.
There's Connie. Connie popped in. How are you, Connie?
I am good. Thank you.
That's good. Thank you very much for being here. We appreciate that. And we've also got, hello?
Yes?
Yes. So back there, had a bit of a bad connection. Also got Dr. Astrid Leffringhausen. Doctor, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Astrid will do fine.
Astrid, okay, I'll keep it at Dr. Astrid. Thank you both for being here. So, look, I've read your paper. It was incredibly powerful, and I think it done a really good job of summarizing a lot of the issues that the majority of people have had these past 2 years in regards to vaccination and sort of the way that it's been handled by our governments, and not only the government, but the health officials. So, first of all, what was it that sort of drove you to put this paper together?
I think it was frustration because nobody would listen. For me, I'm working with scientists, and I feel like, why don't you understand? This is dangerous. What are you doing? And they all got vaccinated around me, and I just couldn't understand that. So I decided, I met Astrid and we had a talk, and I said, look, we need to write a paper. We need to bring it out there that this is not safe. This is not what the government tells us. There's not just two side effects. It's massive amount of side effects you can have, and including deaths. And it's not just a one in a million, oops, it happens like in a normal vaccine. But there's so much more, and the government is just not telling us the truth.
So Connie, you're a senior researcher at the University of Queensland, and you specialised in microbiology. Is that correct?
Yes, I do respiratory diseases that are caused by bacteria.
Yes, okay. So also in regards to livestock, so I believe that, and for people listening who are unsure, pigs are often used as models for humans because of the similarities in biology between pigs and humans. So a lot of your research has been around pigs and livestock. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And we did vaccines development. And coming to that, there's vaccine. Normally, to develop a vaccine in livestock, and we hope that in human it will be the same, it's 10 years. But when I wrote to the TGA in 21, they say even on their website that it is just preliminary approved. I sort of said, but normally it takes 10 years. And I was told by John Skirt, that who's at the TGA, he said, no, it only takes 10 to 12 calendar months. And with the COVID vaccine, we did this even faster. And I was just, I don't know, I was speechless at that, to be quite frank, because how can you in 10 to 12 months, this is the normal approval now, how can you know the side effects? They're not, the long-term side effects, you won't even see them then. So we're basically all guinea pigs.
Yeah, and it was a very patronizing email you got from Skerritt, I have to say. I read it as well, and I thought it was quite insulting.
So was that the email that you received from, who was that? Sorry, the...
John Skerritt?
Skerritt, that he's the head of the TGA, our regulatory system here, regulatory
yes.
Institution.
Okay, yes, I thought as much. So he sent an email to you, and you said it was quite...
patronizing, I would say.
Patronizing, okay. Yeah. Okay. So, all right. Now, Dr. Astrid, so you're a doctor and your field is virology. Is that correct?
That is correct. I did my PhD on viruses, and I have been working afterward. I joined the biotech industry. So I worked with different biotech companies and immunology companies, starting in Germany. And in 2006, I moved to Australia, and I've been working in the fields of immunology and molecular biology, specifically with infectious diseases all my life, but from the other end, so to speak, from the industrial area. So I looked at it from let's say, the industry standpoint. But the background information or background training is actually biology, yes.
Okay. So have you two known each other for a while prior to coming together to do this paper, or was it friendship that was formed?
Sorry, got together by the paper, by the idea of writing the paper, because we were both very frustrated about what's happening, and we're seeing people running into what we thought or still think is more or less their doom without being properly informed. I mean, everybody says you are getting the chance to give informed consent, but nobody gets any information, at least not correct information. So we've both seen this for the last 1.5 years. And then we met and found that we have exactly the same position, and we're both scientists. And that's when Connie said, we have to write a paper, we have to write a review and actually bring this out. So there's a chance for people to hopefully get the other side of the discussion. Most people hear only the official side, but nobody sees what is on the negative side.
Yeah, look, that's definitely something that when people say that they've, you know, they were given the chance to make the decision and it was informed consent, I don't understand how that's possible. I don't think there's a single person that has made, as you said, one side of the conversation was completely silenced. You had doctors and just like yourselves that had their opinions labeled as incorrect and misinformation and silenced. And that's happened, to many experts around the world that have spoken up about what's been happening. So it's impossible for the average person to have been able to make a decision based on the whole picture, because half of it's been erased, essentially censored.
It is censored. It is absolutely censored. And I mean, especially when you work, when your work comes up with mandates, and how can you say anything against that? They're going to fire you. There's always the threat that you're going to be fired if you start speaking against it. And I think that has unfortunately hindered many people and doctors as well to talk out. And you sort of, if you talk out, you get seen as this outsider, or you're just a nutcase.
An anti-vaxxer.
And we are certainly not anti-vaxxers.
I have to say the government made me into an anti-vaxxer. It didn't used to be. I mean, I used to travel as export manager all around the world, and I had to be vaccinated up to my eyeballs, really. But I mean, I am actually I'm at the point where I say there is not a chance on earth I would accept any vaccine without asking serious questions about what is in there and everything. So if you want to know, I am an anti-vaxxer. Yes, I didn't used to be.
Look, I think a lot of people are in a similar position. I never questioned anything, and I've got 5 children, and they've all, besides my youngest, they've all always had all their needles and everything's been up to date, and I did it without asking questions. You just go into your doctor and they give the injection, and you don't ask anything. You just trust that everything's okay because it's something that everyone does. But it's really made you, it's really made me take a step back and start thinking about it more critically and thinking, well, if there's a lot of secrecy and deceit and manipulation with this particular COVID vaccine, then it makes you wonder if that's occurred with any of the others.
Yes, that's correct. And this is exactly the question I have asked myself now a fair amount of times. I have a friend, for example, who her daughter is was diagnosed with diabetes once, so autoimmune diabetes, at the age of 7. And that was a couple of years ago. And I remember she was absolutely devastated because there never was anything like that in their family. So she said at the time, this is probably due to the vaccine schedule that is very, very intense here in Queensland. So children get a lot of vaccines, and this is actually tough for any immune system to deal with. And I remember at the time, I basically just said, that can't be. It's not possible. Vaccine. Because I was indoctrinated like everybody else. You grow up with this, and you are going through your training and your studies, and you think vaccines are fine. You never question this. But then when the vaccines, the COVID vaccines came out, I mean, I did biotechnology at university. I do recognize genetic engineering when I see it. And it was absolutely clear that this was genetic engineering and not a vaccine. So I started looking into this and then started looking into other things and figured out that there are actually a lot of vaccines that have connections to autism and to onset of autoimmune disease, because they actually activate the immune system, and this can always go wrong depending on how they work, and also depending on what kind of additional metals or other things they put in to make the vaccine more immunogenic. So I had to actually, I went back a couple of weeks ago to that friend of mine and apologized when I said I never took this for serious, but now I think you were right and I was wrong, so sorry about that.
When the vaccine first came out, and we need to remember this is a new platform, so vaccines have previously, you put an antigen into you and you know the exact amount, you put it in the arm, the body actually reacts to it, produces antibodies, and the antigen will be sort of used up or degrade, and it's gone. And you have tested it with that amount of antigen. This is a new platform. This is actually your body making this spike protein, which is the antigen. And we don't know how much it is making. We don't know because... And we don't know where in the body it goes. So when they started off, they said, okay, we're using a nanoparticle. That was the first, whoops, really? Because nanoparticles can cross the blood-brain barrier. They can cross the blood placenta barrier. So it was we were told, oh, it stays in the arm. It goes in the lymphatic system, and that's all. But it didn't take very long to find out that it does not do that. It actually goes into your brain, and it can cross the placenta, and it's basically everywhere in the body.
It accumulates in heart, brain, I think liver, ovaries, and bone marrow. And according to the Japanese distribution study,
yeah. And so that wasn't very, very, we knew all this in 2021 already. And then, so nanoparticle was the first, have to be really well researched. Then we have this messenger RNA, which was supposed to degrade straight away. Well, we found out in 2021 that it can stay up for 60 days. So we have no idea how much is produced of this messenger, of the spike protein, how long this messenger RNA stays in there, because the study was only for 60 days. And how much spike protein is produced. And then the next one is that you're producing a spike protein that basically gets brought out to the cells, like in your own cells, gets brought out to the surface of the cells, and your immune system will recognize this cell as foreign and attack the cell. So you're attacking your own cells.
That can't be good.
No.
So they knew that. They did cancer research with this messenger RNA, and they're trying to put this into the nucleus of the cancer cells and to alter it so the cancer sort of basically destroys itself. And why would it not do that with the vaccine? Where is the disconnect there? And John Skerritt said, it doesn't go into the nucleus. Well, in 2021, we found out, it does.
And not only that, it can get reverse transcribed, because we have reverse transcriptases from previous virus infections in our genome. So we can have reverse transcription, which has been shown. So all of a sudden you have DNA in your nucleus, which can easily be integrated. And depending on what position, part of the cycle or the cell is in, it might end up in your genome permanently. So if you have now cells that permanently produce the spike protein. So these options, I mean, this is all options. We don't know that for sure. There have been has been research that shows that is possible. And the thing is, none of this is being researched by the health authorities, by the NIH, by our TGA, by anybody who is pushing these vaccines. And all of these things are potentially disastrous. And that's why we can't sit still and watch this. We have to at least warn people and see if we can get some people to see that this is dangerous and take a step back and say, no, because I said from the start, from 2020 on, when I heard what kind of vaccines they were trying to bring out, I will not take any of these until at least 5 years after full approval, and then I'll talk about it.
Yeah, but not prior to then. Yeah, that's. Yeah. I think a lot of people were of the same opinion when they first started, I guess, floating the idea that the COVID vaccines were imminent prior to their release. A lot of people I know were saying, well, they're going to wait, but they sort of, yeah, they made that impossible. But ladies, I have to quickly stop you there. We've got to take off to an ad break, but we'll continue this chat straight after the ad break.
You should hear what Jesse Zurawel is talking about.
The Dutch government has issued 91 waivers from sanctions against Russia. Since the country invaded Ukraine in late February, the ministries shielded the names of the companies involved, the value of transactions which were exempted, and the business sectors concerned. The information was, quote, company sensitive, unquote, according to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
Powerful people will always secure their and protect their interests, regardless of what could be an overall policy in the company, in the countries in which they are primarily based. So the civilians in Europe are suffering the consequences of supposedly these sanctions against Russia, while those companies who are looking to lose a lot of money for payments not made or for contracts that were not completed, or indeed for already prepaid supplies, for instance, of gas and other so-called company-sensitive kind of materials, had to continue moving forward. So my suspicion is that, as the Dutch government has really proven to be very corrupted by big business, and that's the case for a long time now.
Jesse Zurawel on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Public school is the instituted agency of socialism throughout every community.
The U.S. government has no authority to have any role in education.
We're going
to
lose our very republic if we don't stop this indoctrination of children in government schools.
What happened to us in China can happen here.
Have one kind of education and then call it equity.
It's about outcomes. It's about trying to force us all to be equal.
I think we're going to have a race civil war in our hands.
We are exposing kids to pornography as early as kindergarten. Parents just don't know.
No, not anymore. Not anymore. Parents need to wake up. They don't have the interests of your child at heart.
Truth and Lies in American Education at SalemNow.com.
The climate change lunatics in government and at the WEF will make meat, cheese, milk, and chocolate heavily taxed luxury items to save the planet. Just like private jets, the rich will indulge in whatever they want, while the poor are left with nothing. Remind me how the French Revolution ended again, when the poor had nothing? Lighting the fuse for freedom. TNT Radio.
Welcome back to TNT Radio. Now, either one of you can answer it, that's fine. I just wanted to clarify something for the listeners who may not have a great understanding of, you know, the way that mRNA works and how it enters the body. So you spoke earlier about the lipid nanoparticles and obviously the messenger RNA. So the lipid nanoparticles is like a shell that transports the messenger RNA. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. It's basically, you can regard the entire vaccine, let's say we're talking about Pfizer or Moderna, as something like an artificial virus. So the a virus is nothing but a protein shell that contains some nucleic acid, either DNA or RNA. The messenger RNA vaccines of Moderna and Pfizer are a shell out of liquid nanoparticles. So we're talking about fat and PEG, which is polyethylene glycol, that keeps the whole thing a little bit more stable. There's some cholesterol in there and a couple of other things, actually industrial nanoparticles, and they form a fatty, let's say, shell, And in the middle of that sits the RNA, the messenger RNA, which is also heavily modified to make it more stable. And this thing is basically like a little Trojan horse that gets into your system. And the moment the lipid nanoparticle shell makes contact with the cell and stays long enough to actually make close contact, it's like having a couple of fatty particles swimming on your chicken soup. Everybody has seen that. You have these fat blobs, and when they make contact, all of a sudden it goes blob, and out of two little blobs comes one bigger, it's one bigger. So this is essentially what happens when these lipid nanoparticles make contact with a cell of yours. And then what happens then is, of course, the mRNA, which is in the middle of this fatty blob, is now released into the cell where that has taken up the nanoparticles, so the mRNA, and then it can actually do its job inside the cell.
Okay, so that technology, mRNA, is in Australia is exclusive to the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, but AstraZeneca, which was one that was really pushed at the beginning, but has somewhat gone quiet. You don't really hear about AstraZeneca. It's not one that's promoted, or certainly not as much as the Pfizer and Moderna. So with the AstraZeneca, what's the difference mainly between the AstraZeneca vaccine and the Pfizer and Moderna?
Okay, AstraZeneca is very similar to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So in both cases, the vector is not a lipid nanoparticle blob, but it's actually a virus, an adenovirus. Adenoviruses are viruses that cause common colds and things like that. This is actually a virus that's supposedly made unable to reproduce. So it actually is only capable of delivering its payload, its DNA inside to the cell. So, and what it contains instead of mRNA, which is a very active molecule that is moving in and out of a cell nucleus inside your cell, and is actually the molecule that is directly upstream of the protein. It put the AstraZeneca and the Johnson vaccine are adenovirus particles containing DNA. DNA is a double-stranded molecule, very similar to RNA, but this is actually what is normally contained in our nucleus. This is our blueprint, our genetic blueprint. The DNA is, every cell in our body contains the same DNA, and this is usually in every cell inside the nucleus. And that's where all the information that makes us us is contained. And the mRNA is just a molecule that's made as a copy of the DNA in the nucleus, goes out of the nucleus, and then in the cell makes proteins like the spike protein. So basically, you are looking at two very similar, both of them are biotechnology or genetic engineering. One is going for DNA inside the nucleus. The other one is going for mRNA, which is supposedly staying in the cytoplasma, so not going into the nucleus. That's the difference. That's all. But they're both basically doing essentially the same. They're forcing the cell to become a spike protein factory until it dies.
So why do you think that the mRNA vaccines are getting more of a push and sort of the preferable option in regards to the COVID vaccine?
I think the AstraZeneca had in the beginning had a couple more side effects, and that was due to the fact that that shows an adenovirus that is a chimpanzee adenovirus, and a lot of people had allergic reactions to that. So there were more instant reactions to start with, and then, of course, AstraZeneca is not an American company, whereas Pfizer and Moderna are. I mean, Moderna has strong connections to the NIH. I mean, Moderna, the chef of Moderna, Bancel is his name. He comes from bioMérieux, and they all have connections to each other. They're all producing in the U.S. So they would probably have better connections and be just better connected to the regulatory affairs, whereas AstraZeneca was quite quick with approval in Europe, especially in the UK, because they're producing in the UK. And they are still one of the big vaccines there. But everywhere else, people stopped very quickly with it because they found there was a lot of blood clotting very, very quickly after the inoculation. And it was probably due, at least in part, due to the choice of adenovirus they picked.
Yeah, it's very interesting because there was, as at the beginning, there was a lot of push. In fact, I'm sure that thinking back that AstraZeneca was widely available, whereas I think a lot of people who wanted the Pfizer at the time, I'm pretty sure Pfizer was only Pfizer and AstraZeneca, and Pfizer was a lot harder to get a hold of than AstraZeneca. But as that changed and the Moderna was available, yeah, it's just AstraZeneca was pushed to the side. So I thought, yeah, it'd be good to clear that up. So
another reason is probably thing difference is really that both Moderna and Pfizer, because they're mRNA, which is not such a stable molecule as DNA, and they are actually in nanoparticles, not inside a virus particle. So the entire AstraZeneca as well as the Johnson vaccine are much more stable. They can be transported at cold temperatures or even at room temperature and stay stable much, much longer. Whereas if you keep the nanoparticles or the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines at room temperature too long, the nanoparticles seem to become actually solid. So you can't inject them anymore. So the entire cold chain and logistics of getting those vaccines all over the world was much more complicated than for Johnson and AstraZeneca, which is why they pushed it at the beginning.
Yeah, the Pfizer had to be stored at some incredibly low temperature. It was minus 80. Minus 80.
Yeah.
Well, that's incredible. It's just how cold that is. Yeah, that would have been very difficult to, trying to get it from one country to another must have been extremely difficult.
Yes, and that's one of the things I find could be one of the reasons why people in Australia don't have quite so many side effects as people show in the US and Europe. I find it's interesting that the closer you live to the production side of these vaccines, the higher the amount of side effects are. And it could be something to do with the cold chain and logistics of shipping it, because as you know, during the early days and even until very recently during the COVID outbreaks, the flight schedules were severely reduced. There were not much in the way of flights into Australia. So it would have been difficult to get the vaccines in and get them in, through customs very quickly. And there's a good chance that a fair amount of them got a bit too warm and maybe got degraded, so that a lot of people were lucky enough to get vaccinated, but only got essentially saline. Lucky them.
Like very lucky. That's actually I haven't heard that before. That's quite interesting what you've just mentioned. I'll definitely look into that some more, but that's quite interesting. So before we get into your paper a little bit more, which is the COVID-19 vaccines and Australian review, quickly going back to when you said regarding sort of the push that you got from the top to get vaccinated and the fact that you've seen a lot of your colleagues go and get the vaccine and you sort of couldn't believe why they were doing it. I've often said to people that, and look, this is just my opinion, I'm not stating it as a fact, but a lot of the time when you bring up any of these issues with the vaccines and you try and speak to the average person about them, one of the main comebacks to that is, well, if they were dangerous and if they were really as bad as what you're trying to say they are, why don't more doctors speak up about it? And I recall earlier you mentioned that the pressure on doctors just to sort of comply and just to go along with the narrative was very overwhelming. And a lot of doctors were fearful for their jobs and, you know, having to keep their jobs due to the mandates. Do you think that a lot of doctors are staying silent? Because we know what APRA have done with their protocols to doctors, that essentially doctors have been muzzled, well, health professionals in general have been muzzled to speaking, you know, in a negative way regarding the vaccine. And a lot of doctors have been in trouble for it. Doctors have been deregistered. Do you feel like that's why a lot of doctors are just happy just to sit back and go along with what's happening?
I don't think they are happy, but I mean, first of all, I have lost my job over this because I refused to get vaccinated and I lost my job. I mean, I got a better job afterwards, but I still lost my first job. I had a discussion with our GP and me and my husband, we went there together. And I mean, my husband has some heart issues. So they were pushing him to get vaccinated. And I just hit them with the full amount of information about these vaccines and why I said this is for anybody with heart issues. the very worst thing you can do. And the doctor did not agree or disagree, but he said, and I remember his words, I'm not allowed to speak negative about the vaccines. Later on, when we came back and for another reason or so, we had another chat or so, because we talked to him about what we are doing. We are doing a lot with vitamin D and other things to actually boost our immune system. And the other thing we do is, for example, regular nasal flushes, which is actually really, really good against any respiratory virus, as well as allergies. And the funny thing is, about half a year later, so when we talked to him again, he said in passing, oh, by the way, I'm doing the same protocol as you now.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it? It's something that...
I think it is twofold. It is, I mean, doctors rely a lot on the information that they are given. They not necessarily do all their own research. They're just given. And so I talked to a doctor and she said, I haven't seen these papers. So the question is, what have they actually been given? If they've been given information by the government, there's no way they can actually make a right decision because they're just giving their thing, oh, it's safe and yeah, it's fine, you can do it.
Yeah, and doctors actually rely on their societies. My little brother is a cardiologist in Germany, and I remember I had a long discussion with him about a couple of other issues, nothing to do with the vaccines, but I remember at some point he said, he basically came back to me and said, you know, I mean, if you don't like drugs that your cardiologist prescribes or so, it's your decision to go away, because the cardiologist has no choice. He has to prescribe, when he gets a certain set of symptoms, what his society tells him to. And he can't make individual decisions saying this patient is different, so he doesn't get this, because it's not necessary for him. And the same is true for virtually everything. The doctors are now beholden to their societies, and in many ways also beholden to the pharma companies. In many cases, I have told them already that they are basically drug dealers for the pharma companies. That's a bit rough, to be honest, but in many cases that is true. They don't do any kind of research anymore because they are very, very busy. They have to rely on the summaries of papers and so on they get from their society and from the pharma companies and the pharma reps. And whatever they get told, they basically pass on. And only if they hit severe resistance from a certain amount of patients will they probably stop and start thinking and asking questions themselves. Normally they would just go on, because that's the way it's been going on for not 20, 30, 50 years. I don't know how long.
Well, it's also, it was very hard to publish anything negative, and we've seen a lot of papers that came out and were instantly sort of the journals retracted them. So there was a lot of censorship on what actually came out in the site. I mean, this was actually the worst. I mean, the science was really, it was a one-sided science. Everything that came out was for the vaccine, but there were so many scientists talking out, yet that information did not come into the publication.
Except, I mean, there were a couple of publications I found really amusing, because they started in, normally the publication is set up in a certain way. So you have a short summary to start with, and then you're talk about what they did and material and method, and then you have a summary and a discussion at the end. So what they did was they put in the top part, which is what most people just read, something positive about the vaccines, and then in the body of the publication they basically shredded the vaccines and had all sorts of really negative results. And in the summary they said, but all in all we think the vaccines are still more positive than negative. And that's how they got those papers through, because otherwise they would never have been published.
If that's what's effective and gets the message out, if you have to word things a little bit differently, then I think it's a good thing. I've noticed that a lot more papers recently are starting to speak out, and well, not speak out, but speak, you know, truthfully and give a truthful assessment of what they're seeing. And it's you know, the whole thing from the beginning was, as you said, it was very secretive. There was a lot of deceit. There was a lot of manipulation. And one thing that really got me from the beginning was the fact that they were treating it like a blanket. Like, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're, you know, 15 years old, 35 years old, 70 years old, you had this condition, that condition. It was no vaccines for all. Everyone needs to take it.
Yeah.
And I thought, surely there has to, you know, you can't just do that. I mean, everyone is different. The risks are different. You know, the risks of an 11-year-old boy is going to be very different from a 75-year-old man. Yeah, so,
absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, the problem too was, I mean, the main study was done on adults, and there was
mostly males.
Yeah, and the studies they done on children. I mean, I don't know if you call them even studies to study a vaccine.
And how many of you had 200 children in one study?
I don't know how many it was, but it was just, it didn't go long enough. It wasn't a study where you could say, yeah, there's no side effects. And I mean, we have seen this now, we've seen the results, and that's what I find very, very disturbing is that when you read our paper, most of our references are from 2021. Yet here we are in 2022, and we're still pushing it. And we're now saying little children should have the babies from 5-year-olds. I mean, really, how can that be? We know how dangerous this. It's not safe. It's not safe in any circumstances. We know that children had heart attacks.
And
we're pushing this onto babies. This children, for starters, have minimal risk of ever dying from this vaccine. They have from COVID, from the disease itself, but they have a really big chance of dying from the vaccine. So where is the risk benefit here? There is no benefits for children. And all this was based on they have to be used to make us safe. Excuse me, we should make them safe and not the other way around.
What I found particularly disturbing is really how they push the vaccine on pregnant women all over the world. And all the studies they did, Moderna, Pfizer, everywhere, they very rightfully excluded pregnant women from this the testing, the studies, because that's the most the group that you last want to in danger. So you keep them out, and they were never tested. And then they came out with the vaccines, and instantly everybody said it's safe and effective in pregnancy. Get vaccinated. And there is no reason at all to think it's even safe and effective for normal humans. Certainly not for pregnant women.
Pregnant women and children were listed. Yeah.
Yes,
We're going to run to an ad break, but I definitely want to talk to you some more about the children and pregnant women when we come back. So we'll be right back on TNT Radio.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
Folks, while kids in the U.S. can't read or do math at grade level, according to recent reports, and some of that might be due to the closing of the public schools during the COVID pandemic, the 310,000-member California Teachers Association spends millions of dollars each year lobbying their lawmakers in the state's capital of Sacramento. But it's not just about education policy. So says a report in Politico. The labor giant has staked positions on November ballot initiatives, ranging from abortion rights to vape juice, and its lobbyists champion criminal justice reform grants to help illegal families and affordable housing policy. The report says they've contributed $250,000 to an initiative that would enshrine the rights to abortion and contraceptives in the state's constitution. Another $250,000 would allow a state ban on flavored tobacco sales. These are the people teaching our kids, and that should be very scary to us all. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
Emergency, police, fire, or ambulance?
Yeah, I'm just passing through.
Police, fire, or ambulance?
I can see a whole lot of smoke.
What town are you calling from?
I'm on a mobile phone.
I need the town.
Yeah, there it is. I can see flames. It appears to be a kid or something at the window.
It's okay.
You guys are better out. Serious.
Hello?
000's sole job is to connect you to emergency services. If you stay focused and just answer the prompted questions, you'll get help faster.
It's never a burden to fight for truth.
Lighting the fuse for freedom.
Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to TNT Radio. So before we jump to the ads, we were talking about children, primarily vaccination in children and also pregnant women. And I think the children is where a lot of people really dug their claws in and said, well, no, you know, this is where it stops. You know, I was happy to do it for work. I was happy to do it for, you know, whatever reason, but I will not subject my children to the vaccine. And what we've seen, and I said this the other day, is that Australia has been happy to, I guess in a way, is to, you know, put the children under risk in order to protect adults. And that's something I thought I would never see. I never thought we'd see, you know, children, you know, adults rely on children to protect them. It's definitely one of the more shocking things.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, I had a co-worker and she was thinking about vaccinating her children. And I mean, that was the stage that my heart sank to the bottom, so to speak. And you can't do this. Please read this paper. There was a paper out at that time, why are we vaccinating children? And it was a very good summary from, I think it was from America, I'm not 100% sure. And it basically went through this, that children are no risk and you're not preventing the disease spreading. Basically, this is the one point. I mean, we're pushed all along that we're getting vaccinated, so we stop the spread, which we can see it's not happening. I have in my lab, basically, I'm the only one unvaccinated. Everybody has at least two shots, and they all got COVID. So we're not helping the spread. They're all getting it.
I have an even better story from my sister. One of my sisters is an opera singer in Germany, and she had... she's one of the few people who are unvaccinated. I think there were three people in her opera house altogether who were unvaccinated. And then one of her co-workers came in one evening and he had a sick child, COVID sick at home. He was triple vaccinated, by the way. Everybody else in the opera house was also at least double or triple vaccinated. She said within a week, every single person had COVID except her. She never got it.
And that's another thing. Their natural immunity was totally neglected. So if I get, and I got COVID as well, I'm now actually better protected than any of these vaccines. And that's sort of like when I was young, we had all the measles and God knows all the childhood diseases. I never got them again. So we all relied on our natural immunity to not get sick. And that was totally neglected.
It's not a business model. If you want to sell vaccines, you can't work with natural immunity. Please.
But it was totally neglected. And in one study, they even found out if you get one vaccine and then you get COVID, you shouldn't have a second dose because that actually makes it less effective. And that study was never talked about, obviously.
Yeah, and there were other things. I mean, Pfizer in their clinical study also, apart from excluding all pregnant women, they also included people with prior infection of COVID. And there's a good reason for that, because normally the vaccine is more or less destroying the immunity. And if you had prior immunity from COVID infection, and you destroy your immune system afterwards with the vaccine, which can happen, doesn't happen to everybody, but it can happen, then all your protection is gone because instead of having the broad protection you get when you are confronted with the virus, because the virus is not only the spike protein, it has many different proteins on its surface. So your immune system will build antibodies against all of these different proteins. So instead of getting only one or two antibodies that are specifically against the spike protein in the vaccine, you are getting something like 50 to 100 different antibodies in that your immune system produces against all the different virus proteins. So even if one or two of them, or let's say the spike protein mutates or so, the others stay the same. So let's say two or three of the antibodies that you build after your natural infection are not working anymore. You still have something like 48 that still work. So that means natural immunity will keep on going. Whereas the vaccine immunity, which is so very, very narrow and focused only on the spike protein, will leave you in the dust because it's against a virus that is extinct and has been extinct for almost 2 years now. The Wuhan variant doesn't exist anymore and its spike protein is gone as well. So any kind of vaccination you're getting now that contains this the mRNA or the genetic information for the Wuhan spike protein will force your body and your immune system into super reaction against a protein that doesn't work and doesn't exist anymore. And unfortunately, that the immune system is a little bit of a lazy thing. What it does, it produces antibodies against a certain protein. And if it comes across a protein that is similar but not the same, it'll say, oh, she'll be right. It's fine. It'll work. It's close enough. But unfortunately, it's not, because in this case, it doesn't kill the virus anymore. These antibodies might bind the virus, but they will not kill it. That it's not a neutralizing antibody anymore. And that means these antibodies don't work against the virus. And that's the problem. That's the problem that a lot of people get now.
So you had a really good, you spoke about natural immunity in your paper and the fact that it was ignored. And one point I'd like to mention, because it's something that I was aware of and I spoke about a lot on my show at the beginning, was that the antibodies from SARS, the SARS-CoV-1, they were found to still be in 12 to 17 years.
Yep.
They were still hanging around.
Yeah.
And yeah, that was ignored. And not only was it ignored, I recall them actually denying that it was even probable that natural immunity works. They dismissed it altogether at the beginning. In fact, I remember there was quite a few social media companies that were banning the hashtag natural immunity. They completely shut it down, which that says a lot. I mean, why are social media companies banning people talking about natural immunity? And, you know, when you see that level of censorship, when you see something that's so heavily censored like that was, you start thinking, okay, well, I should probably look into that more, because they're shutting it down for a reason.
Correct. That's exactly right. That's what a lot of people did, that they said, I mean, if people are pushing you almost violently away from something, there must be something to it. Let's have a closer look at it.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's changed. Well, fortunately, I guess it's changed how I look at a lot of things now, where if there's something that's being so heavily censored or we're being pushed away from that line of thinking, it makes me want to look into it a little bit more. But it's just incredible that with censorship that we're being told.
Well, it's basically undermining all the science. They keep on saying we're going by the science.
Consensus, which doesn't exist under science.
No, I mean, science is about, you have a hypothesis, you test it, and it works, and it will not stay there forever. We get new knowledge and it will change. I mean, it is not what we find now might not be what is the reality tomorrow, because some other knowledge came into it. And the principle of science, the main thing is communication of the new things that are found.
And discussion. A lot of discussion.
Open discussion, so we can learn and we can build on the new knowledge and go from there. Otherwise, we're going to get stuck in our old knowledge. And that has been totally undermined by politics. And it is politics that is doing this. It's not science. Science is not telling us that it is safe. Science is not telling us that it is effective. And
maybe a few scientists do, but not the science.
No. And there's no open discussion. We're basically the whole premise was, whoever says anything against it is either a conspiracy or an anti-vaxxer. I mean, you're ridiculing them instead of listening to them. What we do in science, we listen and we think about it and have a discussion.
And
experts like yourselves, like obviously you are both experts in your fields, and you've studied extensively for a very long time in that particular field, that you should have a right to share your opinion or your views on something. And, you know, at the very least, share it, you know, not get shut down.
Yeah, well, I always say to my student, whatever you say, it's not silly, because they sometimes say, oh, maybe my question is silly. And I said, it's not silly. It's a question. You thought about it, so we can discuss it. And you can decide which way is right or wrong. But it is the discussion and the questions that have to be raised.
And you have to also keep in mind, I mean, this is something I learned early on, is that people's brains are differently wired. So everybody thinks a little bit differently. So somebody, if you explain a thing to one person and that person understands it perfectly, you explain the same thing exactly in the same words to the next person, they will not understand it, because their brain is wired a little bit differently. So that means you have to find different ways to explain the same facts. And that way you learn yourself. And actually the other person might come up with interesting questions that you would never have thought of because your brain is wired differently. So having all these different people with different opinions and different ways to look at things is extremely helpful for science. It's the only way you can actually make progress and change the science by saying, okay, we are having a couple of new facts that we have to now work into our existing hypothesis and develop, evolve it into something new that is now up to date and consistent with what the knowledge is today.
Yeah. There's science is changing. It's forever changing. It's growing. It's something that's not set in stone. So while, you know, you might make a statement today that isn't consistent with, you know, the consensus of you know, other scientists or experts in that field, in 6 months or 2 years from now, it could very well be an established fact.
Oh, yeah, that happened a lot over the last couple of years. I remember I said from the start, for example, it's not completely impossible that these vaccines will do anything against the spread of the virus. And the main reason is that this is a respiratory virus, which is infecting your upper respiratory tract. So we're talking about your nasal passages and maybe your throat and so on. It's not infecting your blood. So producing antibodies that curse in your blood, that run around in your blood, will not do anything against infection with the coronavirus. It can't, because these antibodies don't come anywhere close to your sinuses and so on. You have a different immune system sitting in your nasal passages. That's the so-called mucosal immune system that you have in your intestinal tract, and you have it on your and the mucosas in your nose and throat and lung. They have different antibodies. They have specific immune cells, and this is an immune system that is trained in a slightly different way. The only existing coronavirus vaccine I'm aware of is something that a friend of mine who's a veterinarian told me about, and she said the only existing coronavirus vaccine is one for cats, and that's actually one that gets sprayed in the nose. It's a nose spray. That seems to work. Nothing that goes in the blood can protect you against the respiratory virus. It's just simply not possible. So I knew that. I knew that actually in 2021. And about a year later or so, it's now official data. And it basically has been confirmed. And a lot of other things have become true that we knew a long time ago and that are now fact, but that we were fought for it.
Yeah, well, it's there's a spike protein itself has an S1 unit, and the S1 unit is actually the toxin of the virus. So when I work with bacteria and I develop a vaccine, so we have sometimes bacteria that have produced toxins, and the toxins actually cause the disease.
Pertussis, for example.
Yes.
Oh yes, no, of course you're working not with that.
Sorry. So when we did a trial with a bacteria that caused toxin, we attenuated the bacteria. That means it can't live that long. And we injected it into piglets. But we had to make sure that we didn't inject too much of the bacteria because it was still producing the toxin. And when it produced the toxin, you could start seeing the symptoms of the disease. And that is exactly the same with the spike protein. The problem is that we don't know how much spike protein is actually produced. So when I do this with bacteria, I have to have the exact amount of bacteria I'm going to inject into this pig to make sure that it does not produce too much of this toxin to give it the disease itself. But with the spike protein, we don't know how much it produces. The spike protein is a toxin, and it's in the humans and getting produced. And like we found out, getting produced for 60 days. So it's a total new platform, this vaccine, because we don't know how much is produced. We don't know how long it is in the body. All the things we normally know from when we produce a vaccine normally is we know exactly how much we put in. We know exactly how long it stays in the body. And therefore, we can predict the safety much better.
Do you think that's why there's been such a variation in, because there's actually a website that you can go on that's been created where you can actually search for the particular batch number of the vaccine that you've had.
That is my batch, yeah.
Yeah, that's the one. Do you think that's, because one thing I have noticed, and Dr. Robert Malone actually spoke about this as well, is that depending on the batch, the side effects, there's a huge variation between the amount of side effects between each batch. Do you think that's why?
It's part of it, absolutely. The production process, I had a look at the production process, which is enormously complicated. Then you have the logistics issues. Then you have the problem, at least with the old one, you had 6 shots per vial. Now, depending on when you open the vial and how closely after each other you have the shots, let's say you have a vial with a actually functioning proper vaccine, and it's at the GP's office. The first person gets it at 8 in the morning, let's say. The second person comes maybe at 10, gets the second shot out of that vial. And the third person gets it maybe at 3 in the afternoon. By that time, there's a high chance that the vaccine is already degraded. So even a bad batch might be completely harmless by the time it's been sitting in
Connie, I'll have to quickly stop you, Connie.